So I guess just to introduce the first couple of speakers, everyone would know Tim Andrews. He's a legend amongst actuaries, being the GIPC convener or whatever you've been called for the last couple of years, but he's done a great job. Tim's a director of Affinity. He has a particular interest in modelling and pricing of weather-related claims costs, and he leads Affinity's internal climate change team with a focus on assessing the impact of climate change on insured claims costs. Dave McNabb, he's based in Melbourne, also with Affinity. He's got over 10 years of general insurance experience, including 6 months working in the London GI market. He's a member of Affinity's internal personal lines pricing team, including working on climate change. He's previously co-authored a paper, I think, with Tim at the GI seminar a couple of years ago. So if we can maybe welcome, I think they're going to do something funky. David's going to stand here at the lectern and Tim's going to wander around because he's an experienced presenter, and I know how Kearney is to do that. So if we can maybe welcome Tim and David.
So, thanks, Adam. Our presentation today is about pricing for weather-related claims. Now, the idea for this presentation originated a couple of years ago when many people within the general insurance industry were talking about the benign weather claims environment. At that time, we tried to measure the extent to which the actual claims environment had actually been benign using long-term data from the Bureau of Meteorology. We'll be revisiting the results of that work a little bit later in the presentation, but basically it did confirm that the 5 years to 2006 had been benign, and potentially by around 20%. However, the work also raised many other questions. In particular, the role of climate change and also natural climate cycles on the observations that we were seeing. So today's presentation therefore represents an extension of that earlier piece of work. So some of the questions that we've tried to look at are: what has been happening with weather-related claims costs? Are they increasing, are they decreasing, or are they staying about the same? What's been the impact of natural climate cycles, such as El Nino, Southern Oscillation? What has been the impact of climate change, both on the cost to date and also expectations for the costs in the short to medium term future? Should insurers be disregarding their historical weather-related claims data, or is it still relevant in the changing environment? And finally, we'll finish the presentation with a few thoughts about pricing and monitoring for weather-related events and how that might be tailored to the individual challenges presented by the variability of these events. So firstly, the cost of weather-related events. Now, I'm sure most people in the room have got a reasonable idea as to what sort of loss ratios we might be talking here. But in addition to putting that in context, we also want to put in context the actual variability around that loss ratio for both a good and a bad year. So this first chart shows an illustrative net loss ratio for weather-related claims. It's intended to reflect the average level of cost for an average year for an average insurer Australia-wide, net of catastrophe reinsurance. And it covers home insurance, including contents claims and also fire. Now, we've separated the chart into both day-to-day storms and then also the retained weather catastrophes above 50 million. Now, our estimates of the underlying level of day-to-day storm is based on the research that Tim and myself did a few years ago. So that showed that despite the more recent years averaging something like a 12 or 13% loss ratio, the actual level of underlying loss was probably closer to a 15 or 16% of premiums. In regard to the retained catastrophe loss ratio, that's been estimated based on both the Insurance Council catastrophe register over the last 40 years, adjusted for both inflation and population density changes, and also the assumption that the industry as a whole retains something in the order of $500 to $600 million per catastrophe on the property classes. So overall, the average level of underlying loss is around 20% of net premiums, and it's interesting to note that while the retained catastrophes often get the most attention within the industry, It's actually those day-to-day storms that are the significant component of the cost of these weather events. So this next chart now shows that same level of loss ratio, but both bringing in the type of experience that might occur under both a good and a poor year. Now, when we're talking about a poor year here, we're not talking about the most adverse of years, but more the type of experience that might be expected in, say, the worst 20% of years. So the volatility that we've shown in these loss ratios is based on both the Insurance Statistics Australia data and also that's been observed in the Historical Catastrophe Register. Now, as can be seen, that the net loss ratios range from around 12% in the good year up to something in the order of 28% in the poor years. Now, given target underwriting profit margins for these classes of in the order of 5%, it's pretty clear to see that that sort of range of volatility can have a significant impact on the results of even the largest insurers. Now, a little later in the presentation, we'll highlight that it's our belief that the recent 10 to 15 years has favoured more the good and average periods rather than the poor years. So it's perhaps easy to forget just how bad those poor years can be when they do occur.
If that doesn't give you enough of an idea of the variability that you might get from the weather claims, this is just the results by state, again, based on the Insurance Statistics Australia data. It's in this case, it's just the worst and the best loss ratio from weather-related claims on that net basis, again, over a 15-year period. Be a bit careful with the low numbers, because we know in some of the older years perhaps the recording of the storm claims wasn't as good as it is nowadays, but nevertheless it shows that at a state level, very significant variability, and of course at the state level you're going to get occasional very bad years and lots of very good years, and it's when you put it all together you get the kind of results that with the diversification that David was talking about. So that is a big challenge, isn't it, for someone managing a single state insurer or the state manager trying to deal with that kind of volatility and his profitability, and indeed for the actuary and trying to think about how to price the regional differences that come through. What we're going to do now is move on to climate change. I think any discussion about whether related claims costs isn't going to go anywhere at this day and age unless we have a bit of a go at dealing with that. We're not going to go anywhere near the science. You may be pleased to know. I was actually surprised. I don't know how many of you saw the actuarial pulse survey results. I was kind of surprised to see that I think 350-odd people responded, and of those, 35% weren't even convinced we had any warming. Maybe that's just because we are independent thinkers and naturally tend to be sceptical and challenging. In any case, from the reading I was kind of a bit surprised by that result. I saw one of the people in that said that there are a lot of scientists that don't believe it, and that's right, there are a lot of scientists that don't believe. The Fraser Institute paper is actually quite a good one if you want to have a look at, the sceptic's position. Presents it really nicely, and it's got a couple of hundred scientists listed at the back of that are strong non-believers. But they're tiny, I think, in proportion to the number of people that are believing. That's the view I've got too from the various reading I've done. I suppose without dealing with the science, I also just did want to talk about the uncertainty in all of those future projections, and sometimes that manifests in some of these scary things. I think a lot of you have probably seen those IPCC projections of forward changes in sea levels and temperature and what have you, the kind of the 2 to 6 degrees changes in temperature we might get over 70 years or so. And it talks about maybe sea level rises of up to a metre. And it's important to know with that stuff, it doesn't include any of the melt that might come from melting of the Greenland ice shelf. And that's not because it's thought to be unlikely, it's just that we don't know if it's going to happen or not. And the scariest thing about that stuff, I find, is if it does happen, it's going to happen quickly and kind of be irreversible, and it's 6 metres of rise, which is a bit different to, you know, we're seeing these pictures of the Arctic ice melting, and it's kind of like ice in a glass of water, and the ice melts, but the water stays at the same level. But it's all that land-based ice that on the Greenland, and if it falls into the sea, we get big sea rises. So ISCON, there's lots of stuff that's still uncertain about those future projections. One of the ones that we think is quite interesting and we'll be coming to later on is the whole ENSO, so the El Nino Southern Oscillation, and whether or not going forward there's going to be a change in the behaviour of ENSO. Whilst we're going to give a view of the impact of climate change on insurance costs, please bear in mind we're thinking about how different is it now to where we were 40 years ago, and what's it going to be like in the next 10 or 20 years? So we're going nowhere near the tough questions of what it's going to be like 70 or 100 years from now, and we're keeping well away from the really tough questions about this, you know, the social and economic consequences of climate change. We're just focused on insurance impacts. This is some quite good work, I reckon, that Ryan Crompton at Risk Frontiers did. It's the data from the Australian Cat Register, and what he did to it was he firstly adjusted it for changes in the building prices. Well, that's better. I got out of the light. He adjusted it for changes in building prices. He adjusted it then for change in population, and he went to each event, and he said what postcodes did it affect. And you got the population, those postcodes then and now, and kind of grossed it up for the change in the population. And then he adjusted it for change in building standards. So he said, you know, Cyclone Tracy went through now, what kind of reduction in cost would we get because the buildings are built better? And that's the results over 40 years of the way the cat costs would trend over time. It's kind of saying if the Sydney hail occurred now, we'd be up to $3.5 odd billion of cost. So you look at that. And over that 40 years, no clear evidence there of any change over time in the cat rates. So it doesn't include Newcastle, so it'll be kind of $1.5 billion stuck on the end here, the recent storms. So it's not going to materially change the finding from that there's no evidence in looking at that we've got climate change going on. A few things I think are interesting from this we'll come to later on. One's this period through here in the early 70s where there was quite a lot of activity and that was a particular period of La Nina that we'll be talking about. And there's this kind of 15-year period through here where it's been generally relatively light in that period, dominated by El Ninos. Excuse the Spanish, I'm not going to try to pronounce those properly. So we'll be coming back to that stuff, but as far as we can tell from looking at that, no evidence that anything's happening. That, of course, doesn't mean nothing's happening. Now, we're talking about climate change impacting on at the extremes, so potentially having a greatest impact on the more extreme events, and looking at 40 years of data is obviously hard to pick that up with all the underlying trends and variability that we've got coming through. Cyclones. What we're going to do is briefly step through a couple of the perils and talk about what should be happening, and let's have a look at what we're seeing in the data. Cyclones energised by warm sea surface temperatures, so getting warmer sea surface temperatures, and they're already up half a degree, you might expect more cyclones. It's just not as easy as that. So CSIRO are now actually saying we're going to get less cyclones down the west coast of Australia, and we're going to get more, almost unchanged, but slightly more down the east coast. They're going to be more southwards, more polar, so they're going to kind of come down a bit, and there'll be fewer at the top. They do say that the cyclones on the east coast will increase in severity, but it takes a long time for that increase to be coming through. So that's what the science says should be happening. Just have a look at the data. This is now, again, this is work that Risk Frontiers did. It's the number of cyclones crossing the coast, so it has no consequence of whether they caused any loss. This is crossing the east coast. They're weighted for the severity of the cyclone, so it's a number and a weighting based on the cyclone score. Again, there's the 71 to 75 high period. Otherwise, no clear evidence that anything's going on in that chart. If you look at the West Coast data, exactly the same thing. So no evidence coming through yet that we've seen any changes in the cyclone behaviour. And let me say, that doesn't mean there's not an underlying change. But again, we're trying to pick up a trend in looking at 40 years of data in something that happens on a quite extreme basis. And as of yet, it's not visible.
So moving now to the impact of climate change on bushfire. This is an impact that we can be fairly certain of. Hotter, drier conditions in many parts of Australia naturally leads to the expectation that the risk of bushfire does increase. Now, projections are suggesting that there'll be in the order of a 20% increase by 2020 and a 70% increase by 2070 in the number of extreme bushfire days. So with that in mind, this chart sort of considers what's happened over the past 100 years. Now, the chart is essentially a proxy for the number of extreme bushfires. It shows the proportion of homes which in which bushfires has caused the loss of more than 25 or more than 100 homes in a single weekly period. Now, despite the fact that many of us think that the climate has been warming over the last 100 years, and obviously population densities have also increased over that time, so far there's, as with the cyclones and overall perils, there's no real trend in the level of extreme bushfires. Now, this may relate to improvements in fire mitigation techniques, and this will certainly continue to be an important factor going forward as the level of underlying risk gradually increases. However, that said, as showed by the recent US experience, there are times when Mother Nature simply takes over, and so the level of fire mitigation will only work up to an extent. So, moving now to day-to-day storms. Impacts of climate change on day-to-day storms are unclear. There are some areas where the costs are expected to increase and other areas where the costs are expected to decrease. The southwest and southeast of Australia in particular are both expected to be drier going forward. Another observation is that CSIRO talk about weather events being more volatile going forward. Now, all things being equal, that converts into higher insurance-related costs. Now, in relation to the more recent experience, this slide is from the work that Tim and myself did a few years ago, and we were trying to understand how the experience in the 5 years up to 2006 compared to the long-term average. So, to investigate this, we matched insurance claims data for weather-related events with Bureau of Meteorology data on a day-by-day basis for the five main metro areas. After establishing a link between the level of insurance-related costs and also a Bureau of Meteorology rain and windfall-based measure of storms, defined by the storm scores, we were then able to compare the storm scores for the 2001 through 2006 period with those over the past 50 years. So essentially we used the Bureau of Meteorology data as a proxy for 50 years worth of insurance-related weather claims cost data. So this process enabled us to conclude that the 5 years to 2006 were roughly 20% below the long-term average for the metropolitan areas. Now, after discussing this outcome with both some climatologists and also those in the insurance sector, we realised we needed to better understand the impact of natural climate cycles and how they might be impacting the particular outcome we were observing.
Flood claims. Warmer air. Apparently, warmer air means the air can hold more moisture, and that means when it rains, it's going to rain more. So whilst there's actually predictions of less rainfall for most of Australia, especially in the populated areas that we know now, whilst there's going to be less rainfall, it's going to come down in cats and dogs to a greater extent because that warm air will hold more of the water. The theory is also that there'll be drier grounds, and therefore they'll be less able to retain the water, and that means we'll get more of the kind of flash flooding going on. That's the story that we've heard, and that all seems quite plausible. You can't draw too much from this. This is just a short period of flood warning data, covering 91 to 2005. And again, within that data, there's no evidence yet that we've got any kind of big change coming through. Interestingly, that the 96, 98, 2000, they're all La Ninas. 92 92 is neutral, yeah. And a whole bunch of those smaller ones, like 94, there are El Nino years. Again, kind of bringing out the importance of ENSO in assessing some of these costs. So let's move from this stuff into thinking about cycles. We've gotten to the view that we can't assess and decide what impact climate change is having until we can unravel the effects that these cycles are having. So that's what we set about doing. Jump to the next one, David, I reckon. The first thing we did was try to find out what the various cycles that are talked about are, which are the ones out there that are worth having a look at. Can you actually see the... I'll describe it if you can't see it very well. And to be honest, we don't know a lot about most of these effects. They're generally, in terms of exactly what they are and why they are what they are. I think most of you are familiar with ENSO, that kind of affects the east coast of Australia across to South America, and it's the difference in it's often measured by the southern oscillation, so the difference in the air pressures between two areas. That basically, these differences in air pressures drive the way the winds go, drive the direction of the sea surface of the warm water, and then therefore drive the rainfall at the two sides. ENSO seems to have a much bigger impact than it's actually shown on there. Some of the recent work around hurricanes in the US show that the hurricane activity is actually driven by ENSO. So even though hurricanes are kind of occurring over the other side in the Atlantic over there, somehow the ENSO cycle drives this thing called wind shear that impacts on cycles. So I think it just shows how important some of these elements are. So that's ENSO. Equivalent to ENSO is the Indian Ocean Dipole. It kind of sits on the other side, and as best we can tell, it is kind of equivalent. So it's measuring the difference in the pressure between the Australia and over across to Africa, and it again affects where the way the winds blow and where the warm water is. So we're able to get... One of the good things about some of these is because they are these oscillations, these measurements of measured by these air pressure changes, it means we could get data on them to assess how they link to some of the Australian claims costs that we're seeing. There's this thing, SAM, the Southern Annular Mode. It only lasts for a few weeks at a time. It does apparently impact rainfall across the southern Australia. It's changes between the poles and South Australia and impacts rainfall in the South Australia. Then there's some of the other things that are mentioned. You may hear about this interdecadal Pacific Oscillation. It's, as best I can tell, it's another change in pressures that occurs up and down through the Pacific at kind of a high level, and it occurs over decades rather than over years that you might get, say, with ENSO. So the Atlantic's another one of those things, and it drives hurricane activity as a result of the Atlantic. And this thermohaline circulation is all about... It's the like big conveyor belt that you've seen pictures of that take the warm water from the south and drop it up north. It's kind of the Gulf Stream's part of that and keeps Europe warm and stuff. So the ones of these that we've been able to finish up having a look at with the Indian Ocean Dipole, we had a look at ENSO, and we tried to have a look at the Interdecadal Pacific Oscillation, which seem to be the ones that may affect Australian rainfall. I was recently hearing Kevin Hennessy from CSIRO talk, and he said that whilst we'd moved into a La Nina recently, we weren't getting the rainfall we should have, and it's because Indian Ocean Dipole wasn't working for us. And it seems to me that these things interact to some extent and drive the cost that we get coming through. So with all that, we thought we'd have a go at assessing what impacts they are having. What's the next slide, Dave? Oh, you. Okay.
So, as noted earlier, the impacts of these natural cycles on day-to-day storms really shouldn't be underestimated or overlooked. We think around 50% of the variation in the storm scores can be explained by the ENSO cycle. And certainly, if we just draw the attention to the chart, those red circles correspond to periods of strong La Nina conditions and also had above average storm scores. And similarly, the more recent period, which had below average storm scores, has been a period that's been more dominated by El Nino type conditions. Now, within the chart, we've measured ENSO based on the Southern Oscillation Index. As Tim mentioned, there are alternate measures of ENSO. Southern Oscillation is based on the air pressure. There's also alternate measures that are based on sea surface temperatures, but we considered both of those and didn't really find differing outcomes, regardless of which measure you used. So, in addition to the impact of ENSO on day-to-day storms, we've also observed an impact of ENSO on catastrophe experience. So the tables here show the frequency of significant weather catastrophe events in both Australia and New Zealand, subdivided by ENSO period. Now, in preparing the table, we've classified each calendar year as either El Nino, La Nina, or neutral on average. Now, naturally, this isn't completely correct because ENSO simply doesn't follow calendar year cycles exactly. But we recently also looked at looked at the monthly sea surface temperature data and tested our conclusions using that information and found that our observations would be the same, both overall and also on a peril-by-peril basis. So, as can be seen in both Australia and New Zealand, there is some evidence that El Nino periods are better than average for insurers. And further, given the prominence of El Nino conditions over the last 10 to 15 years, that naturally suggests that the actual underlying level of weather-related claims cost is probably higher than what we've been experiencing over that period. So we also considered the impact of ENSO on individual perils, just to see whether the conclusions did differ. As expected, for cyclones, storms and floods, there was a significant correlation with the La Nina periods. The frequency of those events in La Nina periods looks like it's somewhere between 50 and 70% higher than in El Nino periods. In relation to bushfires, we noted that there's never historically been a major bushfire event that's occurred during a La Nina period, which again is probably the outcome you would anticipate. And for hail events, there doesn't really appear to be a definitive bias towards either El Nino or La Nina periods. So just moving on now to summarise our observations on the different cycles that are at play. So as mentioned by Tim, southern annular mode we didn't really test simply because its cycle is too short comparative to our annualised storm scores. ENSO is essentially an annual cycle and believed to explain roughly 50% of the variation in storm scores Australia-wide. This does vary slightly by region. And we also noted on the previous slides that it appears to have a reasonably significant impact on catastrophe experience as well. Indian Ocean Dipole, which was the western equivalent of ENSO, doesn't really have a link with the eastern states, but there is some evidence that it has a small positive correlation with the storm scores in Perth. Interdecadal Pacific Oscillation, as Tim mentioned, that works on a multi-decade cycle. Historically, that's generally been a 20 to 30 year cycle, so despite the fact that we've got something in the order of 60 years worth of storm scores, we've really only got one, maybe two of each of the positive and negative phases of that particular cycle, so that's not really enough to draw conclusions from. That said, the theory around this cycle suggests that in the negative phase, it strengthens the impacts of ENSO, and in the positive phase, it weakens the impacts of ENSO. And lastly, the thermohaline circulation and Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation, again, global cycles that work on multi-decade periods, so we haven't really tested those. So I'll probably just summarise now our conclusions on the natural climate cycles. So firstly, our analysis suggests that ENSO is an important driver of weather claims costs and perhaps the main reason for the benign experience over the last 10 to 15 years. At this stage, a La Nina event is forecast, and that's forecast to continue through to autumn 2008. So all things being equal, we would anticipate a higher level of claims cost will occur during this period. Now, that view is also supported by catastrophe forecasters such as the UK-based Tropical Storm Risk. Now, they're forecasting that the 2007-08 tropical storm season will be something in the order of 10 to 20% higher than the long-term average and potentially the most active season since 1998-99. Now, clearly a key issue going forward is, or beyond 2007-08, is whether El Nino conditions will be more or less prevalent. Now, unfortunately, the science behind ENSO is probably poorly understood at this stage, so we can't have a definitive answer on that. In the event that El Nino events did dominate, well, firstly, the impacts of climate change on insurers would be expected to be lessened over the short to medium term, and secondly, the experience over the past 10 to 15 years would be considered the new normal rather than our current expectation, which is that it has been benign. Of course, an Australian climate that's dominated by El Nino events, while that might be positive for insurance claims costs, does have quite dire impacts for much of rural Australia and water management. But the overarching message from all of this is that it's not possible to have a view about the impacts of both climate change and also the impacts of future weather-related events without first having a view of what's going to happen with ENSO in Australia. So returning now to summarise the impacts of climate change. Firstly, we believe ENSO is going to continue to be the major driver of experience in the short term. Secondly, in many areas, the expectation is that weather events in future will be more volatile, which, all things being equal, relates to a higher level of insurance costs. And thirdly, in terms of the impacts by perils and also regions, there are some areas where the cost is expected to increase, such as bushfire. There's other areas where it's likely that the costs will increase, such as in relation to floods and east coast cyclones. And similarly, there's also areas where it's possible that the costs will decrease going forward, such as west coast cyclones and day-to-day storms in the southern parts of Australia. So finally, just to put all of these increases in perspective, it's our opinion that the increases in cost are more in the order of 1% per annum rather than 5% per annum, and probably the cost increases that have already occurred to date may be significantly less than 1% per annum. So the key point here is that as yet...
We're saying it's closer to 1%. We're not suggesting it actually is 1%, because it's probably much less than 1%.
Yeah. The key point here to make is that to date, climate change has not had a significant impact on changing the costs of weather-related events in Australia. Next point is, in terms of the data that insurers use to price weather-related events, we'd encourage people to continue to use as many years as available, particularly given our belief that the last 10 to 15 years have been benign, both in terms of day-to-day and catastrophe events. For portfolio managers with exposure which varies by region, we'd encourage you to consider CSIRO's latest findings, which demonstrate some of the regional influences, because certainly there are some areas which are more impacted than others. And lastly, while our investigations focused on the impact of climate change in an Australian context, the global impacts are definitely still relevant, both in terms of the cost and availability of reinsurance.
Thanks, David. Adam's keen for us to finish, so I'll do that quite quickly. If you'd just jump to the data slide. You probably think I'm loony. How much data do you need to analyse weather-related claims? If I just start at the bottom here. On the non-weather cats, so non-weather-related day-to-day storms, I'm suggesting you can't just use 10 years of data and think you've got it okay. If you use 10 years of data and supplement it with external data that helps you think about how that 10 years relates to the bigger picture, well, maybe that works okay. But otherwise, I think you need to be careful thinking, okay, weather... I need to get a bit more data, 10 years is enough. I'd kind of challenge that, and as I said, you probably think I'm a bit loony. As you kind of move up into the retained cats and the low layers of the cat program, I think you really need to supplement it with a lot more external data and with the results of the cat modelling. I feel the cat modelling is an underutilised resource in helping us price the differences by peril and in terms of allocating the cost of the cat program and in thinking about the retained cost by zone. So just encourage you to think about that. And use as much data as possible. David, how about you just jump onto the a couple through now? Yep. One more. Yep. I just want to finish with a couple of very quick thoughts about the way insurers report on the profitability of property-related classes. Not all insurers do this. Some have got it nailed to a greater extent than others. But I suspect it's an area we can all still improve on. And I'm thinking here mostly about reporting, but I suspect it has some impact on pricing as well. If I could just get you to focus firstly on this right-hand table. It's the performance insurers would have been seeing in some of the recent good years for each of buildings and contents. The attrition loss ratios, they're coming from the ISA data. They're the numbers the insurers have actually been getting. the retained weather events, again, are the kind of numbers they've been getting for each of buildings and contents from that data. If the reinsurance was spread equally for buildings and contents and with a bit of expenses that we made up, that's kind of an indicative loss ratios, and you say, well, both buildings and contents is actually running pretty well, and the overall combined ratios have been, you know, nicely in the 80s. Sitting behind that, the actual performance, in my view, that would sit behind that is actually closer to this underlying position. So it's the same level of attritional and expenses. The reinsurance is split on a more cost basis, so it reflects the contents, of course, much lower. And a lot of insurers are probably dealing with that already with their, you know, if the reinsurance charge is per sum insured. But the retained weather is actually quite different on an underlying basis, and what we've actually got is buildings potentially being borderline or unprofitable, not far away from it, and an even more profitable contents business. I think a lot of the actuaries recognise that. Do a lot of the insurers recognise that when they're looking at their numbers? I think to a lesser extent, because we're not always presenting the information to them like that. And again, I know some insurers have nailed this stuff, but I just really wanted to harp on it. If we brought in some differences by zone as well, it kind of gets even worse. If you went to a high-risk buildings area, the number kind of pops up to 115, say, Sydney buildings, and Melbourne contents, it starts getting even lower. So you kind of, you know, building regional effects into that. Unless we start allocating these cat costs properly and dealing with the variability in retained weather, then we're kind of misleading about the performance that's coming through. That's enough on that. So if I just conclude today, we've kind of covered a range of things that all link to weather, and the ones I'd like to bring you with, to leave you with, are, you know, insurers in managing and reporting on long tail classes recognise that they're difficult. They've got long tails and they need special approaches. I don't know that insurers have made that same leap in the way they necessarily report on and think about these property classes, but I'd be encouraging insurers to do that. So the variability of weather means the property classes need special approaches. ENSO is a link to the benign experience that we think insurers have been having over a kind of a 10 or 15 period. We're now in a La Nina, so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out going forward. A key thing, I think, is anyone that is telling you what the climate change impact is going to be on insurance can't tell you unless they can tell you a view they've got about what it's going to do to ENSO, because it's not clear that it's going to stay to behave the way it has in the past. As best we can tell, climate change is not yet a material difference, but it's going to emerge slowly over time. If I could leave you with one thing, it's 10 years is never enough for pricing weather. Try and get as much as you can, try and get external data, and try and develop these monitoring reports that deal with the different type of profitability. Thank you, and Adam, I don't know if we've left any time for questions, but, well, we'll leave it with you.
So just following on from what you said then, you talked about ENSO in terms of it being a... there being a link that you've established between ENSO and insurance claims or costs. I guess, to what extent do you think that insurers should start using that information to factor into their own pricing or perhaps, more relevantly, premium liabilities? And if so, how far forward can we predict those sorts of metrics?
Mm. Oh. You go for it.
Righto. At this stage, the projections of ENSO are really only accurate over roughly a six-month period. So in terms of factoring in differing prices by different future year, it's a little bit difficult at this stage. That said, given the sort of six-month accurate timeframe that they do have, it can be of use in establishing differing loss ratios for premium liabilities. But probably until the science becomes more exact, the key use of it is really as a hindsight test of the more recent periods, as we've sort of highlighted, to say, well, future costs are going to be higher or lower relative to what we've had over the more recent periods.
And besides the premium liabilities, I can imagine companies could use them in their budgeting processes. So this year they could be budgeting for a slightly higher, 2008, slightly higher levels of weather-related costs because of the La Nina that we're in.
Okay. Now, whoever wrote this question, I know Tim is dying for a volunteer to be an examiner. so somebody has posed this question. Your board has asked you how you are responding to climate change in your pricing. Please write a one... other than the long-term change to the base rate, he's got increased, debatable, what should insurers be doing in terms of pricing? I guess it's partially related to the last question, but...
I think insurers definitely need to be thinking about regional responses And one I can think of is the Gold Coast area. We didn't talk about storm surge, but there is over time going to be an increased storm surge risk. The cyclones are going to be more polar. Gold Coast has already got a big storm surge risk. It's kind of increasing that. And I think it's an area an insurer may want to say, well, gee, perhaps I should be thinking about rebalancing my book away from that particular area. So whilst we've kind of focused on it and said, so far, not a big change, if I was an insurer, I'd be thinking about some of those regional differences that may come through. I think the flood risk is the other one that's interesting, where it's not just climate change that's leading to increased costs potentially over time, but it's community expectations, and it's one I think insurers need to be doing more work to think about how they're going to either underwrite or price that risk. And in fact, I know a lot of that work's going on. I don't know how close the industry solution is to actually getting there. It seems to be taking a long time to me, and I think that's a reason why insurers need to be looking to do something themselves.
Okay, I think that's about all we've got time for. If everyone can join me in thanking Tim and David for a thought-provoking presentation.